Welcome to the debate. Imagine a fire alarm goes off in a crowded building. The instruction is incredibly simple, right? Just get out. But what if the only exit leads directly into a fragile, irreplaceable nursery? The choices go from binary and clear to, well, deeply, terribly complicated.
Right. Yeah, you smash the door, you save the people, but you destroy the nursery. And the reality is, in emergency governance, when those alarms go off, the institutional instinct is almost always to just smash through the door. I mean, urgency becomes the ultimate unassailable justification for destruction.
Exactly. And that impossible scenario isn't just a thought experiment. It's the exact problem Dr. Bichara Sahali tackles in his 2026 methodological companion paper, Testing Life-Coherent Peace Under Tragic Choice.
Mm-hmm.
The paper sets up this harrowing, entirely realistic crisis. We have thousands of climate-displaced people who urgently, desperately need emergency shelter, clean water, medical care. But, and here's the catch, the only administratively available land for them is an ancient, old-growth forest.
And you know, this isn't just a patch of trees. This forest is a vital ecological watershed. It's a massive carbon sink. And most crucially, it is the sacred, non-substitutable life ground of an indigenous community.
Right.
It is the absolute definition of a tragic choice. Both sides are invoking life. On one hand, you have immediate physical human survival. On the other, you have indigenous self-determination, ecological continuity, and the survival of future generations.
What I find so breakthrough about this paper, though, is its proposal to actually navigate this. Dr. Sahali introduces what he calls the Life Coherence Arbitration Protocol. It's designed to guide decision-making through these tragic collisions of life needs. I'll argue that it physically stops institutions from relying on deeply flawed decision models and provides a practical discipline that prevents premature sacrifice.
Yeah, well, I see the ambition there, but honestly, I read this and I see a terrifying vulnerability to technocratic capture. I mean, while the protocol is theoretically beautiful, I'll be arguing that it just masks coercive institutional power behind a benevolent vocabulary. It really feels like it overpromises on theoretical harmony in the face of sheer brutal tragedy.
Well, let's look at why the protocol is necessary in the first place. Think about how we currently handle these crises. Most institutions default to what the paper calls money sequence calculation.
Right. Cost-benefit analysis.
Exactly. They try to slap a dollar value on things that simply do not have a price tag.
Yeah.
They look at the forest and calculate timber value, or they look at the displaced people and calculate the cheapest construction costs per head. Or, even worse, they default to pure administrative expediency, just doing whatever is fastest to get the problem out of the headlines.
Which is a real problem. I agree.
Right. So what this protocol does, by mandating specific concrete requirements like mapping life capacities and establishing absolute red lines of irreversibility, is it forces institutions to find what the paper calls compossible options.
And compossible, meaning a win-win scenario where multiple life needs are protected together.
Right. It forces the system to exhaust every other possibility first, using degraded land, mobilizing emergency funds, deploying temporary modular settlements. All of these have to be completely ruled out before any irreversible sacrifice of a non-substitutable life ground is even considered. It's bringing rigorous discipline to an impossible situation.
Okay, but I come at it from a completely different way. The diagnosis of the problem? Flawless. Cost-benefit analysis cannot price a dead child or an extinct species.
Right.
But the proposed cure, I mean, it requires affected people who are in the midst of profound trauma to navigate a highly structured matrix of academic concepts. The protocol demands we map out autopoietic unities and structural coupling, which...
Wait, let's unpack structural coupling for a second, just so we don't get lost in the jargon.
Sure.
In plain English, we're talking about how a living thing, like this indigenous community, is so deeply intertwined with its environment that if you destroy the forest, you are literally destroying the community's ability to exist as a culture. It's not just, you know, using their land or inconveniencing them. It's an amputation.
Exactly. It is an amputation. But requiring a community to prove that amputation on a multi-dimensional evidence dashboard is a recipe for epistemic colonization.
Oh, I don't know if I'd go that far.
Yes. It's what happens when you force someone to translate their entire reality into the language of their oppressor just to be heard. Furthermore, the protocol's core assumption that compossibility is always discoverable, that there is always a hidden win-win if we just look hard enough, is a profound theoretical luxury.
A luxury?
Yes, a luxury that completely falters in true emergencies, where time is scarce, resources are finite, and the state holds a monopoly on force.
Well, you call it a theoretical luxury, but look at what happens when we don't have that luxury. We default to panic.
I wouldn't call it panic, I'd call it triage.
But the protocol's requirement to seek compossible options before making sacrificial trade-offs, that is the engine of the entire framework. Because it actively delays the rush to destruction. Think of a circuit breaker on Wall Street.
Okay, but a financial market isn't a refugee camp.
Just bear with me. The mechanism is the same. When a flash crash happens on Wall Street, the circuit breaker doesn't magically solve the underlying economic crisis, right?
Right.
It freezes the market to stop the algorithms from blindly destroying billions of dollars in seconds due to sheer momentum. That's what this protocol does. It stops the administrative momentum of just bulldozing the forest because it's the path of least resistance.
But at what cost?
Well, it halts the default rush to the cheapest, fastest land seizure. It forces decision makers to pause and uncover hidden options, like distributing shelter networks across neighboring towns or repurposing vacant commercial buildings. It stops the state from simply pointing at the forest and saying, "Look, we have no other choice."
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that the pause is harmless. Let's be incredibly concrete here about what that circuit breaker actually means on the ground. We are talking about human beings.
Of course.
We are talking about children facing disease, severe dehydration, developmental injury, and trauma right now. Pregnant women facing high infection risks. Every single hour that the state spends pausing to map life fields across 12 different domains, which, by the way, includes consulting downstream communities and projecting impacts on future generations, that pause costs actual lives.
But the delay...
The delay itself has a mortality rate. That is the biological reality. When you mandate a search for compossibility in a life or death emergency, you are inherently privileging the status quo.
I disagree.
But in this specific scenario, the status quo is that the ancient forest remains beautifully intact, while displaced people suffer in overcrowded, failing temporary conditions. Urgency isn't just some administrative excuse concocted by lazy bureaucrats. It is a brutal biological reality.
Urgency is a biological reality, yes. But Dr. Sali addresses this directly in the text. The protocol doesn't deny the need for emergency shelter. What it does is force a distinction between needs and wants.
How so?
Well, between actual survival means and mere conveniences. The displaced people need immediate shelter, clean water, and safety. They do not necessarily need permanent concrete housing or commercial infrastructure built inside an old-growth forest.
But who is pushing for concrete housing in a crisis? They just need tents and sanitation.
The contractors, the logistical supply chains. In these crises, the institutional machinery will push for immediate, heavy development because it serves their money sequence interests. They want the road access. They want the timber revenue from clearing the site.
That's a fair point about the contractors, but...
So the delay you are criticizing isn't about ignoring dying children while bureaucrats draw charts. It's about making sure that in our rush to save them, we don't cross a threshold of irreversibility for the indigenous community. Because here is the hard truth. A cash payment 10 years down the line cannot restore a bulldozed sacred site.
No, it can't.
Compossibility demands we secure physical survival without irreversible cultural or ecological destruction.
Okay, that's a compelling argument, but let's look at the administrative weight of the mechanism itself. This brings us right to the issue of who controls the terms of the decision. Who is running this circuit breaker?
The implementing authority, ideally with community oversight.
Right. The protocol claims to protect the indigenous community from epistemic violence through what it calls participatory languaging. Dr. Saheli leans heavily on the idea that human beings bring forth worlds through language. So to avoid making the community speak in academic jargon, the protocol offers a language compact or a translation guide.
Exactly. It translates the academic framework into human, community-facing questions.
Yeah, instead of asking about structural coupling, the state is supposed to ask, what must stay intact for your people to remain whole?
Which prevents the state from monopolizing reality. It forces them to ask what the community actually values in their own terms.
But come on, let's be real here. The translation guide itself is a trap. The paper explicitly warns that if a community must translate its sacred relation to land into state-approved vocabulary, cultural violence occurs. Yet, what is the protocol actually doing in practice?
It's giving them a voice.
By forcing indigenous communities to fit their ancestral law into a ranked needs matrix or a red line threshold matrix or a non-reductionist evidence dashboard. I mean, you are asking an indigenous elder whose living continuity is tied to that specific forest to sit at a table in the middle of a humanitarian crisis and plot their sacred ancestry onto a dashboard. It inherently frames their existence in the language of administrative arbitration. That is the exact epistemic colonization we are supposedly trying to avoid. The state is still dictating the shape of the table, the rules of the game, and the software running the dashboard.
I see your point about the dashboard, and it's a valid fear, but aren't we just assuming the worst of the mechanism? I would frame the dashboard differently.
How?
The protocol is acutely aware of the danger of technocratic capture. That is exactly why the dashboard is explicitly designed to be non-reductionist.
How can the dashboard be non-reductionist? By definition, it reduces reality into manageable data.
Because it explicitly forbids a single aggregated score. If we use a traditional cost-benefit analysis, everything gets reduced to a dollar amount. But under this protocol, communities co-define the categories of harm and evidence themselves.
Okay.
If the indigenous community says, this specific grove is a sacred site and crossing it is an irreversible rupture of our cultural lineage, the protocol doesn't tell them to quantify that trauma out of 10. It doesn't weigh it against the cost of a water pipe. It registers it as an absolute red line threshold of non-substitutability, period.
But they're still weighing it.
So if the state brings public health data regarding cholera risks and the indigenous community brings sacred law and oral memory, the dashboard holds them in the same field of judgment. It physically prevents the system from saying, well, the cholera risk is an 8 and the sacred law is a 4, so the cholera wins. It refuses to collapse qualitative testimony and quantitative data into a single metric.
But holding them in the same field of judgment implies there is an ultimate judge looking at that field. And in a crisis, who is the judge? It's the implementing authority. It's the state.
Yes, but...
And this leads directly to the limits of the anti-coercion safeguards. The entire framework relies heavily on rules. It says minority reports must be preserved, emergency powers must expire, repair must be funded before harm proceeds. But in a tragic collision of life needs, the state holds the monopoly on force.
Right, but the rules are designed to constrain that force.
On paper, yes. But mechanisms like expiring emergency powers or independent review councils are so often just hopeful administration. I mean, imagine the reality.
I am.
The media is screaming about people versus trees. There are horrific images of suffering, displaced families on the nightly news. If the state decides to send bulldozers into the ancient forest to build a camp, a minority report filed in an evidence dashboard isn't going to stop the treads of the bulldozer.
Well,
you cannot put a sunset clause on the trauma of displacement or the paving of an ecosystem. The state will do what the state always does when pressured. Prioritize the most visible, politically explosive crisis.
Hold on. Let me play devil's advocate against my own point for a second. I agree that the state has the power to ignore the rules and send the bulldozers. But I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning as a critique of the paper.
Why not?
Because you are comparing the protocol to a flawless, non-existent utopia where power imbalances don't exist. We have to compare it to the alternatives we actually possess. If we throw this life coherence protocol out because it might be captured by state power, aren't we simply surrendering to the demonstrably worse alternatives?
No, we are acknowledging the reality of power.
But if we reject this, we default to administrative expediency. where the state acts unilaterally without even having to pretend to listen. Or we default to moral absolutism, where one side's claim becomes a political weapon against the other. Or we go right back to crude money sequence calculation, right, where the forest is just priced as timber and the indigenous claim is ignored entirely. What this protocol does is fundamentally shift the burden of proof onto coercion.
Shifting the burden of proof in a document does not shift the balance of power on the ground. A bureaucrat can write a very eloquent justification for coercion,
but it creates an institutional requirement for minimum sufficient force. If the state is going to use coercion, if it absolutely must seize land to save lives, it must legally justify that it is using the least dominating option capable of preventing serious harm.
Okay, but...
And furthermore, it mandates that repair must be fully funded before any harm proceeds. If ecological damage to the watershed is foreseeable because they are setting up temporary camps, the restoration funds must be locked in beforehand. This isn't just hopeful administration. It is a structural redesign of how emergency governance operates.
It's an attempt at one, sure.
It shifts governance from unilateral command to a nested accountability. It forces the state to look at the displaced families not as logistical units to be warehoused, and the forest not as vacant, empty land, but as interwoven living systems.
Look, I don't disagree that moving away from treating people as logistical units and forests as vacant land is vital. That is a shared goal. Where we differ is on the mechanism of enforcement.
Fair enough.
Dr. Sahali writes that decisions serve life grounds, not institutions. It's a beautiful sentence, but institutions are the ones reading the dashboard. You mentioned that repair must be funded before harm proceeds. Tell me, how do you fund the repair of a severed cultural lineage?
Well, the protocol explicitly says you can't.
Exactly. The text explicitly states that cultural and ecological loss cannot be priced away. Some losses are entirely non-substitutable.
Yes.
So if the state proceeds with the temporary high-density modular settlement that inadvertently fragments the old-growth habitat and disrupts the watershed, meaning downstream communities now face water insecurity, funding a repair is a bureaucratic fantasy. You are masking the sheer violent brutality of the tragedy behind the reassuring administrative language of a recursive repair cycle. It makes decision makers feel good about doing bad things.
The text absolutely does not mask the tragedy. In fact, the paper itself actually includes a really sobering caveat about what it can and cannot promise. It states unequivocally that it cannot promise perfect harmony.
Right.
It doesn't pretend that every conflict has a painless win-win solution. What it promises is discipline under constraint. If irreversible loss is truly unavoidable, if there is literally no compostable option, no degraded land available anywhere, no distributed shelter network possible, the protocol ensures that the sacrifice is named, minimized, and publicly justified.
But does naming it change the violence of it?
It prevents the loss from becoming a silent externality. It forces society to look directly at the tragic trade-off, rather than hiding it behind a sterile cost-benefit analysis that shrugs and says, well, the economic value of saving the lives outweighed the timber value of the trees.
And I argue that the exact moment you structure that gaze through an 8-step bureaucratic protocol, you sanitize the violence. You make the state feel justified in its coercion precisely because it filled out the non-reductionist dashboard and preserved a minority report.
I see what you're saying, but...
Think about Johan Galting. He taught us that cultural violence is the language or belief system that makes direct and structural violence look normal or even necessary. I genuinely fear the life coherence arbitration protocol, despite its incredibly noble grounding and life value in the biology of love, risks becoming a highly sophisticated mechanism of cultural violence.
Wow, that's a heavy charge.
It provides a benevolent, progressive-sounding vocabulary for the state to do what it was always going to do anyway, prioritize legible, immediate human needs over complex, intergenerational, and ecological life grounds.
But stopping the state from doing exactly that is the entire purpose of the irreversibility threshold. The mandate to draw red lines is designed to prevent crossing those lines for short-term administrative convenience.
Right.
Think about it.
If the state merely prioritized legible human needs, it would pave the forest without a second thought. The protocol forces the state to see that the forest is not just nature or scenery, it is the structural coupling required for the indigenous community to remain viable. If the state paves it, the state fails the life coherence test internally by its own mandated metrics.
Which is a brilliant diagnostic tool. I will concede that completely.
Thank you.
The framework functions perfectly as a diagnostic lens to see where structural violence is occurring. The water privatization case from the earlier sections of the paper proves that beautifully. When you shut off a family's water because they can't pay a bill, you are subordinating a biological necessity to the money sequence. It is a life value inversion.
Exactly. The diagnosis is absolutely piercing. But moving from diagnosis to arbitration in a tragic choice, where time is literally running out and people are suffering in the mud, that is where the friction lies. The arbitration protocol requires a level of shared power, a slowing down, and epistemic humility that institutions simply do not possess during a crisis. Perhaps they don't possess it currently. But isn't that the work of building a genuine civil commons? We have to design governance systems that demand that humility, rather than just throwing up our hands and saying tragedy is too messy to regulate.
I'm not saying throw our hands up, but...
The Life Coherence Arbitration Protocol provides a vital evidence-based discipline that prevents premature sacrifice. It forces us to ask, mechanically, what life capacities are enabled or disabled by our actions, and it ensures we don't cross irreversible thresholds blindly.
And while it diagnoses the flaws of our current systems accurately, we must remain incredibly cautious of any highly structured protocol that attempts to arbitrate competing life needs. It risks sanitizing state coercion and overpromising on theoretical harmony when faced with brutal, time-sensitive tragedies.
Well, it seems we have arrived at a point of convergence, even in our deep disagreements over the mechanism. We both completely agree on Dr. Sahaly's foundational premise. Traditional money sequence calculations, those cost-benefit analyses that try to price the priceless, and purely negative definitions of peace are entirely inadequate for navigating modern crises.
Oh, absolutely.
When ecological boundaries, indigenous rights, and urgent human suffering collide, the old tools fail us catastrophically.
100%. The status quo of treating the natural world as a resource to be extracted and human beings as data point in an economic equation is a profound failure of governance. The source material really offers a critical, ongoing inquiry into how societies might navigate unavoidable limits.
Which brings us right about to the fire alarm and the fragile nursery. When the alarm rings, we can no longer just smash through the door. We have to figure out how to survive without destroying the conditions that make life worth living in the first place.
Indeed.
The question remains open on exactly how we do that, but the necessity of the attempt is undeniable. Thank you for joining us on the debate.